guys, and welcome back to another episode of Candid, where we have real talks with real people. I'm your host, Shanae, and today I am here with Selena.
Hey.
Hi. So there's been a lot going on, guys, and yeah. So last week we talked about immigration and Lincoln Bain and his followers, well, people who supported his cause, I should say. I don't want to say followers, because they probably were there to support his cause. They had a protest, and apparently he was arrested, and they were escorted and said that they were illegally gathered, or whatever that means. And he fell, and I think it was, I can't remember who the other minister was. They had comments. We talked about those comments. We talked about immigration and the rhetoric that the Coalition of Independence Leader and Deputy used. So that's just a brief synopsis of what we talked about last. And we also talked about price control, because the government, you know, inflation and all is very crazy. And the government had decided that they were going to implement price control, well, add 38 categories of items to the price control list. And that affected 5,000 items. And basically they sat down with pharmaceutical companies in the country, well, retailers and grocery retailers, and they explained to this, explained what they wanted to do. And of course, the pharmacies and the grocery stores owners, they expressed that they wouldn't be able to keep their head above water if they were to do these things. Now, I don't know how true that is, because we didn't see any numbers, which, and I wish we did, because it's kind of hard to pick a side when you don't have all the specifics. It's kind of just he say, she say. But yeah, they said it wasn't feasible for them and they wanted a different agreement. And the government was like, you know what? This still happening, but let me know if you come up with any new ideas and we'll look at it. So I think it was the Bahamas Pharmaceutical Association. They said that they sent their recommendations, but they received no answer. And it was like a week or something, I think, maybe a week, almost a week, passed, no answer. And November 1st came, and I don't know if you guys saw, but I'm pretty sure every person who's been paying attention or who used the pharmacy in this one day or 2 day period noticed that pharmacies, well, major pharmacies were closed. And yeah, in response to that, the government decided to bulk up their public clinics to handle the influx of possible patients or people that needed medication coming in. So yeah, and also what I found interesting too, grocery stores, they didn't decrease their prices on the items they were supposed to decrease their prices on. So I found that interesting, and I was like, okay, how is the government going to handle this? And I was like, honestly, I didn't think that the government was going to give in. I thought they were going to let them sit for a couple of days. Somebody was giving, but I didn't think the government was going to give in right then and there. But I figured that it would probably, the government would have to lose on that, because it's either the consumer was going to lose or the business is going to lose. And if the business goes down, well, if most pharmacies close down, then all of the burden is going to fall on the government. So at the end of the day, it's kind of like, it ain't no winning in this situation. So yeah, that happened. So apparently the Pharmaceutical Association and the Retail Grocers Association said that the new price control regulations specific to the pharmacy sector are untenable and not sustainable. The association has instead recommended that government eliminate value-added tax and duty on medicines and ensure that price control officers ensure that savings are passed along to the customers. That was their recommendation. Yeah, so 2 days after that whole statement came out, they finally came to a resolution. I can't remember exactly what the resolution is, but yeah, so pharmacies open. Bahamians ain't got, well, residents, it don't have to pay $100 for certain things anymore. I'm guessing that the government subsidized in some way, whether they be cutting taxes. I don't remember. They didn't specify exactly how they were going to cut costs. So
the only thing I would say is that I was very surprised when I heard the talk about the price control or whatever the case may be, and it's not anything new. The government has been trying, especially coming from the family island, like almost every 3 months, okay, price control will call to come down because the prices are outrageous. Persons are literally living off knowing, I guess, taking advantage of the situation that they're in, knowing that they're in a position where persons really need these things. And so they have no choice but to pay an arm and a leg to get these things. And it's pretty sad, because I understand businesses run on profit, but that much of a profit, especially in a country where I was listening, I can't remember what the talk show was today, who I was listening to on the way home, but they were saying that Bahamas love to look down upon Haiti, whatever the case may be, but our economic status when it comes to economic status is just the same as Haiti. You literally do not have a middle class. You just have the extremely poor and the extreme wealthy. And he said that they were in a sad case. Now, I don't know if this number is accurate, but I do know that a lot of Bahamians are in a state where they don't even have $300 within their bank account. Our middle class is like literally almost depleted. He said that 10% has wealth or whatever over 300, and then we just have those who are under 300 literally living paycheck to paycheck. So it's very sad that these services where these things are really needed have a problem. Now, I'm not saying, like you said, negotiations. I don't think that, what am I trying to say? A profit is needed in order for business to continue, but I appreciate the initiative that the government is taking to ensure that these businesses are not going overboard with it. And I don't think there's nothing wrong with it, but like, I'm glad that they were able to come together and sit and negotiate. I'm just hoping that at the end of the day, we be human enough to consider those among us.
Yeah, I definitely agree with what you were saying. And I wanted to piggyback off of what you were saying regarding what you heard on the talk show and saying that, you know, a lot of Bahamians don't even have $300 in their bank account or they're living paycheck to paycheck. And I feel like in this country, a lot of politicians like to act as though so much people live above the poverty line, but would they really, they create this poverty line, right? And basically, if you fall under it, you're considered poor. If you're above it, you're considered middle class or surviving, whatever they want to call it, right? But I feel like in this country, our poverty line is not realistic, because if I can barely afford to put a roof over my head, right, and feed myself, then I'm not going to consider myself middle class. And that's where I feel a lot of, it's interesting to see, because a lot of these people make their network. Pay attention to the next time election come around when they have to disclose how much they're worth. Pay attention to how many politicians are millionaires. Pay attention to it. And they are sitting here. I can't remember who it was specifically. I think I saw this live, maybe like a couple of years ago, where they were talking, or a particular politician, I can't remember who it was, or someone related to politics in some way. And they were basically saying we don't as much people. They were trying to dispute the fact that there are a lot of poor people in the country, right? Because they're saying, oh, if you don't fall under this specific number, you're not considered poor. But in my head, I'm like, but if I barely making it, then I would consider myself poor or barely scraping by. I consider middle class somebody who can live comfortably. They're not extremely rich. They're not the 1%, but they have a nice home. They have a nice car. They can afford to certain luxuries in life, not every luxury, but certain luxuries that they enjoy. And we fail to realize that a lot of Bahamians, a lot of people living in this country are living paycheck to paycheck or just to afford somewhere to live. They have to split the rent with somebody else or to split bills with somebody else, and that shouldn't be the case. And I'm glad that the Prime Minister said it himself, but the minimum wage, even the new minimum wage, is not a livable wage. And we understand that it's not a livable wage. So why are we pretending as though the poverty line is accurate? So I find that's just something I wanted to touch on that I found interesting. It was a bit off topic. So I feel like we have to stop, we have to be empathetic with other people, even business owners. Because me personally, if I'm a business owner and I'm not going to hire somebody until I'm making enough money where I can pay them a decent salary, a livable wage. I'm not going to hire somebody and pay them $250 or $250. I just can't do it. That's just me. It ain't, I don't see it. Because if I'm struggling living, or if I've been in a situation, why would I put somebody else in that situation? Oh, minimum wage jobs are unskilled jobs. That's incorrect. You have to have some sort of skill, whether it's communication, whether it's adding and dropping math. Like, you have to use some skill for this job. You just don't go sit there and be blank and sit there all day and don't do nothing. Come on. So I don't like that term, unskilled labor per se. So yeah, it's just my thought. Like, just be empathetic to people and understand what they're going through and why these things are important, why an increase in wage is important, why a decrease in taxes is important to some, of course, the country still needs taxes to run, but if a lot of people are living in poverty now, it doesn't make sense to continue to tax people who are suffering, in my humble opinion. So like, this is stuff that we have to look at, you know, and a lot of people were talking about it from an economic standpoint, saying, oh, the raise of minimum wage is going to result in job loss and blah, 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 which is based on economics, right? I don't know much about economics, but I feel as though the reason people are going to lose jobs is because businesses are going to cut back because they now have to pay their employees more and they want to stay within their budget. That's just my humble opinion. So if you ask me, and I'm not talking about small businesses or businesses that are just getting out of there, I'm talking about like big corporations as well, because they want to spend less money. And that's just what it is. So I feel like it's kind of unfair to use that to say, oh, don't raise wage because people are going to lose jobs. Like, I understand, but at the same time, it's just like, that's so weird. Like, so we're going to stay making $210 minimum for the next 20, 30 years because you don't want people to lose jobs. At the end of the day, people are going to lose jobs regardless. That's just the way the cookie crumbles, I guess. But moving on, I don't know if you guys remember, I think this was October last year, 2021, Michael the Archangel attempted to remove the statue of Christopher Columbus in front of Government House. Like, this man was literally, he was going out, like, he was trying to break this statue down, right? So recently, I think this was sometime earlier this week, maybe, the communications director, Latrey Raman, said that the statue has been placed in storage and at the Ministry of Works until it is determined what it will be used for in the future. And since that incident, and after the I think it was the rename of the holiday, National Heroes Day as well, because, you know, we had something called Christopher Columbus Day. There have been a lot of calls for an anti-colonial movement aimed at the liberation of cultural identity and Bahamian icons, and the removal of colonial representations in Bahamian society, including the nation's currency and statues in historically significant locations. So I don't know if you guys know Dr. Curry. He used to be a professor at University of the Bahamas. And he said that what that gentleman did, Michael the Archangel, he did what a lot of people couldn't voice or express. And he said it was a catalyst for a much wider conversation about complacency to enact legislation that would allow for monuments and reminders of the Bahamas colonial past to be transferred to a dedicated location such as a museum, and the lack of Bahamian figures in strategic locations and the absence of a national heroes park. So my thoughts on this is, I think it should have been taken down a long time ago because Christopher Columbus ain't no saint. We like to spread a lot of false information saying that, oh, he discovered the Bahamas. How, when he met people here, he killed, he raped, created mass, like literally mass genocide. He was not a good person, like based on the actual history and the actions that he displayed, he was not a good person. So why are we celebrating this man? Why are we saying that, oh, the Bahamas was discovered by this man? Like, okay, yeah, he had great sea voyages because he learned that you could travel from, I think, east to west. He figured that out and all. But I mean, like, he didn't discover anything. He discovered it for their side of the world, but people were already here. So why are we celebrating it? If anything, we should be celebrating the Lucayans, the original people. Like, make it make sense. And like, a lot of people during that time were arguing that, oh, it's a part of history, blah, 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 blah. We understand that it's a part of history, but we're not saying that to delete that part of history. And we're saying to put it somewhere else because it doesn't deserve to be in front of Government House. So,
okay, where do I even begin? So when we think about it now, the reason why it's be in front of Government House is because, remember, that's where the governor general lives. And remember, the governor general is the representative of
the queen. The king now.
King, Lord, I ain't even ready for that. Anyway, moving on. So now, if I remember history correctly, Christopher Columbus wasn't sent by Britain. He was from Spain, or whatever the case may be. But however, to me, both of them, the government house and the statue represented colonial reign to me. And so, like you said, Mr. Curry said, he did what a lot of Bahamians couldn't voice. And the fact that you had the questions over and over again, well, if we're an independent country, why do we still have a monarch as our head of state still on books? And why is it that we still have a lot of practices that, you know, basically we're neo-colonialized. And so it's an interesting twist because we're not really independent on books, yes, but technically we're not. But the conversation arises where, okay, if we were to become a republic, where would that leave us? And that's a very serious thing, because when you think of the ramifications of removing yourself from the ties that you have with a not colonial power, but, you know, one of the first world countries. As a country on a whole, we're not able to defend ourselves, which is one of the main reasons why, you know, a lot of persons would state, well, I don't know, they don't understand why there is so much detest towards the colonial past and present, because we can't defend ourselves. The Defense Force and Police Force, if anybody decides to declare war on us, we might still throw up the white flags one time, because we have no, if we remove ourselves from the Commonwealth completely and try to go on our own, we cannot possibly stand on our own, especially in the face of war. And so that's another reason why I kind of pulled back from my end colonial reign or whatever the case may be, because we have to be very realistic of it. But however, getting back to the topic, when it came to the statue, I remember, I will not say who, but one of the persons very close to me was telling me that we as Black people are very ignorant, because that's our history, and why is it a problem for there to be a statue of him? And I was stating that, and like, I was so glad that you said it. It's not us trying to erase our history, but you have to remember that was carved, and a statue is for monumental purposes. And like you say, there's nothing that needs to be remembered or glorified or celebrated when it comes to Christopher Columbus. He was not the first to discover our country. He was not the first person to land here. History literally falsely tells the story of him. And the first step was removing the holiday. And I think another step would be to remove the statue. Now, to say to completely do away with it, I would think it would be best to put it in one of the museums that we have. Like, for instance, we have Pompey House, and we have like, I think it was Pompey House that had the display of slavery artifacts and stuff like that in the Bahamas. I'm not saying to erase these parts of history. I'm just saying that a statue should not be erected in honor of him, or should be allowed to stay up. I believe that it should be stored somewhere within the museum, but not in the capacity of which it was. And so I am honestly glad that he did it, because it kind of sparked that revolution. And what's crazy is that he will go down in history. A lot of persons look at him as a crazy person, but he will go down in history and doing something that a lot of us did not have guts to do. And so that's my 5 cents on that.
Yeah, like you said, it's not erasing the history, because like you said, Michael Lamarck, the archangel, he's going to be written down in history as the man who tried to destroy Christopher Columbus. So I feel as though that'll be a very interesting story to tell if it was in one of the museums, you know what I'm saying? And a lot of Bahamian, it's interesting to me that like you said, that close said that we are ignorant to our history. I disagree. Well, I agree to an extent, but she's saying that for the wrong reasons. What we're taught in school is not Bahamian history. What we're taught in high school is not Bahamian history. You have to go out, you have to seek for yourself. And then like a lot of information. When I went to University of the Bahamas, I took about 4 or 5 history classes. 2, I think, were built into my curriculum. But that was more about media, because I studied journalism. But I chose to study Haitian migration. I still chose to study history of the Bahamas 1 and 2. And I think it was another one as well. And I learned so much in those classes that I've never even fathomed. I've read good chunks of books created by Bahamians, Bahamian historians who have written, who've like, I don't understand. Like, I'm sorry, like, I'm just lost for words. The fact that we have so much resources, we have quite a few people here who are very knowledgeable, such as Gail Sands, Dr. Christopher Curry, these people who've done extensive research into Bahamian history, yet this history isn't being taught in school. Yet on our BGCSEs, we're still talking about American history. The only thing we ever talk about that's related to Bahamian history is the Lucayans. And then we talk about slavery in the Bahamas. Please correct me if I'm wrong. And I feel like that's an issue. That's a problem. And a lot of Bahamians what we're being taught, they then glorify colonialism, and they think that Christopher Columbus is this hero, and a lot of other misconceptions that are wrong, and they don't know any better. And most people aren't gonna, you know, go just read random books about Bahamian history. It's not gonna happen. Let's be honest. The average person isn't gonna do that. But I feel like we should start teaching the truth. So like you said, the first step was renaming the holiday. I feel like the second step was moving the statue. And I think the third step should be moving towards fixing our curriculum surrounding history so that children are being taught the truth and not a whitewashed or colonialized version of what we believe is history or what they believe is history.
I'm so glad that you brought up the classes because, to be completely honest, one thing I'm really thankful for is the Professor Shanti Seymour, as well as Professor Curry, and also Craig Smith, I believe. Not Craig Smith. What's the next one? Anyway, Ian Bethel. They really opened my eye to a lot of our history that is almost, like you said, whitewash and try to be buried in order to keep this friendly relationship between us and our those who colonialized us. And a lot of persons are believed, even, you know, you hear about slavery in the Bahamas, but a lot of persons, when you think about slavery in the Bahamas, like, it's not in comparison to slavery in America. However, that is another misconception about slavery and how it happened within the Bahamas, because all those brutal things that were happening in America also happened here, but persons don't even know that. And so when it comes to now the discovery of the Bahamas and what happened, really, it's almost done. I could remember in civics learning about slavery, whatever the case may be, but it's almost like slavery is not really touched on per se, or talking about the different riots, the different slave persons, like, you know, how America had the Underground Railroad and persons like Harriet who really stood up. We had slaves as well in the Bahamas who went against, and some of them were even hanged and killed for what they did. But we have stories like that, but it's not being told. It's almost like slavery, it's just a surface thing, and then they go straight to the riots, and even the stories about the riots and what happened and what they had to do, it's not done in detail. And I think we do ourselves a great injustice by doing that, because when, I think it was a quote that says, when people don't know their past, they won't be able to really touch in their potential and their future. And as a country as a whole, if we don't know where we've come from, then how do we know where we're about to go? I watched a video of a man, I cannot remember his name, but I just had to pause and listen to what he's saying. He said that, you know, anybody who's around a kid knows that the most popular thing right now is TikTok and learning the TikTok dances. I mean, you would see 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds shaking their sides, you know, learning these dances like nothing, singing these songs, doing these challenges. And he said that, do you know, we know that TikTok was created in China. And he said that the algorithm for TikTok is different in China than it is in America and the other countries. He said that in order to sabotage the development of a country, you go to their youth. And he said most reels within TikTok in different countries, you would see dances, you would see silly pranks, you would see all these other things that are not, I wouldn't say not bad per se, but too much of it, to the intake of it, when you're watching it, you feeling happiness or whatever. I can't remember, what is the chemical that goes off? Dopamine. And so now you equate that foolishness with dopamine and happiness. And so that's why you keep on doing it continuously. So while your youth, the country's youth, is now just focused solely on being able to do these dances, or just, you know, brainwashed by different things that they're seeing there. Not to say that that's the only content and not that there are other content, but the majority of it, that's what's being pushed. The algorithm in China is persons excelling in their studies, agriculture, architecture, all these different things to not so much brainwash, but to reinforce what they're already learning in school and in their community. He said that the future of a country is based on their youth. And how do you, the best weapon is not war, but you sabotage the youth of a country in order to, you know, propel your country to get a better head over them. And I was just like, wow. I mean, I'm just paraphrasing. But I thought to myself, I'm like, wow. Because literally as a teacher within the school, that's all I see. That's all they're interested. But Santa, let's make, I don't have a TikTok for the same reason. Let's make a TikTok. Oh, let's come to this challenge with me. That's all you hear. Nobody's interested in their grades. Nobody's really interested in their studies. It's just like, we're babysitters and they get this information and it's okay. I'm just waiting till I go home so I can make this new video, learn this new challenge, be able to do this, be able to do that. And it's just, it's very sad to see what this man is saying. It's really, that's the reality we're at right now. And I just say, Lord have mercy when it comes to our country, because if this is what our youth, the generation of tomorrow, not even so much tomorrow, today really, if that's what they're into, and we already see America building this huge embassy. We got China right there. I'm just like, talks about becoming a republic. But I don't think even if we were to remove from under Britain, I just believe we're just going to be the first picks for any other first world country. Because we're not really pushing or not really doing what we need to do in order to prepare our youth for the generation to come, to be in order to be leaders. And guess what, at the end of the day, when the old order comes out, there has to be a new order. And I wonder what the faces will look like if we're not teaching and forcing our students to take their place, to take that place. And God forbid they follow the same old order, because we really would be in problems still. So that's just my 5 cents on it.
Going back to what you said, talking about the lecturers that helped open your mind, I remember the first class that I took my first semester was 119. This is an English class, the first level English class with Dr. Shanti Seymour. And I learned so much in that class. It was a hard class, man, and I was mad because I wasn't getting the grades I was used to, right? But I'm very glad that I took that class, because it was in her class that I learned that we speak a Creole. We don't speak, because all your life you heard, you learn, oh, I speak in Bahamian dialect, this is that and the next. And I always thought that Creole was just Haitian Creole, like that was their language. But she explained that, no, a Creole is basically when two languages merge and kind of have like another little language with words, different words from this place and words from the next place or whatever. Because, and she explained to me that we get the way we speak from our ancestors, the Gullah Geechees who came from Africa, and then obviously the language of our colonizers mixed with that, and that gives us Bahamian Creole. So that's why we have the boy and the this, the IS, and like I really enjoyed that class for that very reason. I learned that. That's something I learned. And I always, whenever I hear somebody miss saying something, I like to correct them, because if you know better, if I know better, I won't do better. And I sharing what I know with you. So if you choose to remain ignorant to what I'm telling you, and that's on you. But I feel like I've done my part as a person to try and help educate you on something. And I want to change that narrative that, oh, only Haitians speak Creole, because I feel like we stigmatize the word in its sense, in a whole sense, just because we attach it to a certain demographic of people, which is also wrong. And I don't even want to get into that right now. We've been talking about that very often on the show, but you guys know what I'm trying to say. Like, we feel offended when people will feel offended when I say, oh no, it's not a dialect, it's a Creole. They feel offended. And that's not something you should be offended by. It's just the truth, literally the truth. And this lady has, I think she has a master's or a bachelor's in, I don't know which one it is, maybe even a doctorate, I can't remember. She extended her credentials to us, but she has a degree in linguistics. And she extensively studied the Bahamian language, and like she's well qualified, you know. So I just wanted to share that piece of information with you again. I'm pretty sure I shared it maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, don't recall, but I'm sharing it again for those who may not have heard it before. Yeah. So guys, I'm gonna restart and come back. Okay. Yeah. So segueing into another topic, Social Services wants to launch a program that will help with domestic violence cases. And early in the year, we did a whole series on domestic violence. We talked about domestic violence against women, against men, violence against children. as well, and how to identify signs, how to help stop this if you can, and how to get away, and you could who you could contact. So the Bahamas Crisis Center was one of the places that you could contact, and their number is 328-0922. And they help men, women, and children in abusive situations. So if you do know someone that is enduring domestic violence, or if you are going through it right now, you could contact them and they will help you as best as they can, again at 328-0922. So the Ministry of Social Services and Urban Development are collaborating to hopefully create a research unit that will help examine data better. And it is their hope that it will be up and running in the coming weeks. So the Minister of Social Services and Urban Development, the Honorable Obadiah Wilscombe, said that one of the difficulties we met when I became minister is a lack of data. This has been an issue, but we are now creating in the ministry as well a research unit that's responsible for the collection of data, because without data, it's very difficult to contend with the issues. He also said that there are some 60 active domestic violence cases that are being investigated. However, he said that they, even though they get statistics, it takes time to organize and to store. And he said that this is a joint effort between the Royal Bahamas Police Force and the Bahamas Crisis Center. But he said the biggest problem is manpower. And it's kind of difficult to put all of that on the police because, you know, they're dealing with a lot. So the whole point of this research unit is to help gather data so that they could help assess the problem and try to get to the root of the problem and hopefully help solve it. He also said that there are about 1,500 cases of violence against children. Now that is crazy, that are pending. So this unit will also be a legal unit, and they will be assisting the police in the work that it has to do, and they will be bringing in lawyers and some investigators to ensure that we are more active. So basically, like you heard, the hope of this unit is to help solve delay problems and to get cases out sooner and to get the information needed to address these issues. So I think this is a very good idea. I think it is about time that this happened, especially after the year that we've had with the amount of women that have died as a result of being in domestically abusive relationships. And I think this research unit would help get down to the bottom if it's successful, and if it's run how they hope it will be run, it will help understand these cases better. It will help us understand the mental capacity of these individuals. Maybe they, I don't know, have some type of trauma that they're dealing with, like extreme trauma, because I know hurt people. And I don't know, but it would give us a better understanding, because like the Honorable Obadiah Wilscombe said, it's hard to gauge what's going on when you don't have the data. Well, you have the data, but you don't have an understanding of the data. And so you just have all this raw data and you don't know how to comprehend it. So as a result, you don't know how to fix the problem. So I feel like this is a great idea, and I hope that it works as it should. And I really pray that it helps, because I'm so sick and tired of seeing this. And it isn't even just women, it's men, it's children as well. Children are abused as well, and it's a lot on just, like you say, just the police force. We've even talked about how the police force handle these situations, and in some cases it wasn't the best way to handle these things. But I don't know, I guess all of this would get down to the bottom of that and maybe understand why victims don't trust the police, why they choose to deal with it by themselves, or whatever the circumstances may be. So, yeah.
I agree with everything you said.
Yeah, but I just think it's a really good initiative. And it's good to see that this government is coming in and they're acting on the things that they said they will do so far. And I'm happy that is one of the things that will be tackled. And like I said, I just hope that it works. Like, it works the way they want it to work. Because, you know, sometimes we underestimate how difficult some things may be. But I just hope they get there. So the last thing I wanted to talk about, well, I lie. It wasn't the last thing. The next thing, I lie, because I saw this post right before we started recording. So I don't know if you know. So it's called SERZ, and it stands S-E-R-Z. It stands for Special Economic Recovery Zone. So after Hurricane Dorian that ravaged the Bahamas. I think that was in 2019 or 2020. Can't remember. It's been about 2 years now, so 2020. And the government, as a result, had a SERS order in place, which basically allowed people to rebuild, to get, I think, grants from the government was a part of it, and to bring in things duty-free, bring in vehicles, bring in building supplies at a reduced cost so they can get their lives back on track. So 2 years after the aftermath of Dorian, the government announced that they will not be extending the program, and that they didn't say that they won't help. They said that they won't extend the program because it would leave too many holes and people would begin to take advantage of it, is what their stance was. However, they said that they would go by case-by-case basis, and anyone who needed help, and they looked at their case, and they meet all the criteria, they would help them in whatever way they knew how. So they're not stopping anything completely. It's just that it's not going to be open to everyone. It's not going to be free reign. You know, you have to apply for these things for whatever reason, right? And I think So Grand Bahama is asking for an extension of the SERS order so that they can continue to rebuild. And I don't know how I feel about this. I feel like I get where the government is coming from. But then on the other hand, I understand that people are struggling. And 2 years after a Category 5 hurricane is crazy. Like, that hurricane literally decimated the entire island, and I do not think that 2 years is long enough to rebuild. So I could understand why Grand Bahama, the residents of Grand Bahama, are asking for an extension, because, like, did y'all not see the same island at all? Like the land was completely flat for the most part. The island was covered in water for the most part. So I don't think 2 years after losing my entire house, after rebuilding my life, after probably losing jobs, having to relocate, maybe that 2 years is not enough for people to rebuild their lives. So I think I stand with the government on this one. However, I feel as though he should have been more clear on what he meant by case-by-case basis. Me personally, what I would have done, I would have closed it off to the public so everybody doesn't have free reign. However, those that are still in the islands that are affected could apply through an application process and say what they needed, how, when, and where. And if it checked out, then we grant them the necessary help that they needed. So I think, I don't know if that's what they have going on, but it should be an efficient process that can help these people as quickly as possible. So, yeah. Yeah, so the last thing I wanted to talk about today was going to be carbon credits. So basically, the Bahamas is exploring the option of blue carbon credits. Carbon credits are permits that allow the owner, that would be the person that are buying them from us. So for instance, if we are selling carbon credits and the U.S. wants to buy them from us, once they buy them, they become the owner of the carbon credits. They will be allowed to emit a certain amount of carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases. So basically, industrialized countries or countries that produce a lot of waste, like United States, China, they would buy carbon credits from smaller islands like us that don't emit a lot of pollution in order to help, big emphasis on help balance the depletion of the ozone layer and all of that, basically. But basically, it don't make sense in my opinion. Let me tell you why. And they pay us money for it, obviously. So climate change scientist Marjan Finlayson says that investing in this new industry will not solve the climate change issue. Finlayson affirmed that carbon credits are a way for governments to potentially get funding, and in theory, the system seems to be justified. Okay, pause. Okay, so basically, every country emits greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gases are what contribute to climate change, which will result in summers getting hotter, winter's getting colder, the sea level's rising. As we know, the Bahamas is only a little bit above sea level. So if climate change begins to, if it continues in the way that it's going, we're going to be underwater. However, our country is so tiny, we don't have a lot of factories, we barely contribute to the depletion of the ozone layer, to the depletion to climate change. We barely contribute to that. We do, of course, because everybody has a carbon footprint, but not as big as industrialized countries. So because we produce so little, countries that are industrialized that produce a lot of pollution more than they should, because I can't remember the agreement they have, but anyway, more than they should, what they do is they buy these credits so that they could produce more greenhouse gases, basically. So they, for instance, US buys carbon credits from the Bahamas so that they could produce more waste legally, basically. And this is supposed to be a way to help decrease climate change, help decrease the amount of greenhouse gases in the air. But if you think about it, it kind of doesn't make sense. It's not slowing down pollution. It's not stopping climate change. It's not slowing down the amount of greenhouse gases being produced.
I thought the object was to help lessen the amount of carbon waste that a country, you know, but it doesn't make any sense. It pays us to what did it say to produce
it's basically to take our ale that's unpolluted so that they could pollute, basically. I guess that's the simplest way I could put it.
Rational logic.
But it's about money.
That's all it is. Literally, that's all it is. And guess what? Who's going to benefit from it? Not us.
Because we'll be underwater. We can see if you're under here.
I wasn't even talking about that. It was just from an economic point of view. It's like, okay, and we're going to benefit from this. How? Because they're still trying to figure where the VAT money going. But anyway, that's another topic for another day.
Yeah, so this scientist, let me finish reading what she was saying. I found her comments very, very interesting, because when this topic first came up, right, and I think this was something that was talked about in the national debates around election time, and then it also came up prior to that, and I was like, okay, maybe the math ain't mathing to me. I was like, okay, I understand we're getting paid for this, but to me, it never made sense, because I'm like, I mean, I wouldn't call myself an extreme environmentalist, but I can't help the environment, and I try my best to reduce what I can. I'm not going to be out here making excessive garbage for no reason. You know what I'm saying? I take pride in the way my country looks and certain things like that. So I'm not extreme. Like, I don't have a metal straw. I would like that one. I don't have a metal straw. I don't drive an electric car. You know, like, my house don't run on solar panels. But I try in every way I can to reduce my footprint, right? And I feel like it doesn't make sense to allow these larger countries to buy carbon credit. It just doesn't make sense to me. It's allowing them to not be held accountable. It's allowing them to go over their pollution limit for lack of a better word.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but how it works is that, okay, if they continue to produce what they the amount that they want to produce, right, and the ozone layer depletes within their region, isn't it also going to have an effect on everywhere else?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, I just I'm really trying to sit down and think about who came up with this with this idea, because I'm just like, is the environment really your main concern? Because I'm confused.
Yep. So this lady, she said, okay, Philinton affirmed that carbon credits are a way for governments to potentially get funding. In theory, the system seems to be justified. However, trying to stop climate change is impossible. Instead, the idea is to slow it down. But carbon crediting does not guarantee that. Carbon credits and the carbon crediting system is a means to get funding that can possibly help with more efforts in terms of adaptation and supposed mitigation efforts. The whole idea of carbon crediting is a theoretical idea of balancing emissions. The problem with this solution, you know, the issue isn't, it doesn't take into account that with the voluntary market itself, this is not a regulation as it should be enforced. So that's also an issue. And she said, if everyone stopped burning fossil fuels today, there would still be enough carbon and other hazardous gases in the atmosphere to continue global warming and other effects of climate change. So the idea rather is to stop adding high amounts of carbon emissions into the atmosphere to slow down the climate change, something that we have no control over stopping, according to Finlayson. She said, however, she's not convinced that big companies giving countries more money and then emitting more carbon into the atmosphere will help to reduce the impacts of climate change. And I feel like anybody who wants to understand can understand what this lady is saying, and I agree with her wholeheartedly, because the whole point is to try, she said it can be stopped, but the whole goal is to reduce carbon emissions, to reduce the amount of pollution in the air. But instead, you're like, you know what, I'm not gonna slow down my pollution. What I gonna do is, right, this country don't create a lot of pollution, so I gotta pay them some money so I can buy a piece of their air, which is still, it's still technically not our air, but anyway, yes, take some of the air and I could produce this much square foot of carbon dioxide and the other gases. And yeah, so I ain't go over my limit this month. Like, huh? Your goal should be trying to figure out how to produce the things that you produce without producing as much waste. Because it can be done. Plastic bottles are being made out of algae. There have been zero waste soaps created, metal straws, biodegradable plastic bags. All of these things that have become popular over the last 5 to 10 years, if all of that. 5 to 10 years. Why are we just making these mainstream now? Because climate change is getting out of hand now. So now we want to try and mitigate it, but we had years and years and years and years to use this stuff, but we didn't. So I didn't even know you could make biodegradable plastic bag until we get that plastic ban. I didn't even know it was a thing. I mean, besides the cloth bag, obviously, but I mean, like, but why? If these things were here from the jump, why wasn't that always the standard? Why were we intentionally polluting the earth? Why were we intentionally throwing millions and millions and millions of pounds of plastic into the ocean, killing wildlife? Like, make it make sense. Maybe I just overthinking it, or maybe I didn't think about it right, or maybe I explained it wrong or understand it wrong, but I only could explain to y'all the way I understood it and give a different perspective. But from where I stand in, I just urge everyone to try your best to reduce your footprint as best as you can. You know, I know everybody can't afford an electric car because electric cars are bit more expensive. Try your best to maybe invest in metal straws, make small changes, maybe stop buying toothpaste in the tube. They have little like toothpaste tablets that you could order and you like chew them and they turn into toothpaste, which is so cool. I actually want to order some of those. Instead of buying a plastic toothbrush, you could get a wooden toothbrush. Instead of buying soap, shampoo in a plastic bottle, you could buy shampoo bars. Like, it's so much different alternatives that I've been learning about, especially over the last couple of months. I just urge y'all to look into it. Yeah, that's my 2 cents. That's my advice to y'all. That's my little, you know, my little takeaway from this episode. But I really enjoyed having a conversation with Saluna. Dudley did just today because he's sick. He's always sick. I'm pretty sure in the episode before last, Dudley was sick. Now he's sick again. He's always sick. But anyway, yeah, so thank you guys for tuning in to another episode of Candid, where we have real talks with real people. You can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Candid242, where you can keep abreast on everything that we're doing. When new episodes are coming out, you can ask questions, you can engage with us. So yeah, see you next week and keep it real, Bahamas.